think most people are here now, so I'll begin this morning's talk. And as I mentioned last night, this morning's talk will be on jhanas, what they are, how they arise, and what's their meaning in the practice. And just to introduce, I want to read out a little passage from the Mahasatika Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this was just after the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. I begin this passage in the middle of the sutta after the Buddha recalls having gone through 6 years of very harsh ascetic practice. And whatever recluse and Brahmin at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking practice or austerities, I have not attained any superhuman states, any distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment? I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to enlightenment? Then following on that memory came the realization, this is the path to enlightenment. I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? I thought, I am not afraid of that pleasure, since it has nothing to do with essential pleasures and unwholesome states. I considered, it is not easy to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and bread, and I ate some solid food. Now at that time the 5 monks were waiting upon me, thinking, if our recluse Gotama achieves some high estate, he will inform us. When I started to eat the boiled rice and bread, the 5 monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the recluse Gotama now lives luxuriously. He has given up his striving and reverted to luxury. And I'll mention about the rest of the story, was that he, having eaten the solid food, regained my strength, then quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, then the second, third, fourth jhana, under the Bodhi tree. And that was the story of how the Buddha became the Buddha, enlightened. There's two very important parts of that, quite a few important parts of that story to bring to your attention, that by experiencing the austerities, that he hadn't gained anything. He recalled that he entered into a jhana under the rose apple tree as a young boy. He thought, could that be the path to enlightenment? Following on that memory came the realization, that is the path to enlightenment. Later on in the suttas it said, Samadhi Mago, Asamadhi Kumago. The path of Samadhi, Samadhi is the path. No Samadhi is the wrong path. I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure? It has nothing to do with sensual pleasures. And if any of you get afraid when you come close to jhanas, remember, just before the Buddha became enlightened, he too was afraid. It makes you feel a little bit better. And also it shows that that is one of the obstacles which have to be overcome. And the Buddha overcome it. Why am I afraid of that? Because it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures. It has nothing to do with unwholesome states. And indeed, as I'll point out in a moment, the reason why you should not be afraid of that is because it's the pleasure of letting go. Identify it as the pleasure of letting go and giving up things, and you'll know it has nothing to fear. It's not something which is conducive to attachments. And lastly, he had to have some solid food, have a good rest, so his body was fit enough to be able to gain those meditations. And thank goodness that that actually happened, otherwise it would not be a Buddha. First thing about jhanas to mention, from that story, it's, I know that sometimes people say that jhanas were pre-Buddhist, and that one of the things which was peculiar to Buddhism with other things, like sometimes they say vipassana, sometimes they say anatta. But if you research the story of the Buddha, from passages such as that, it seems quite clear that the time the Buddha sat meditation under the Bodhi tree, and before then the Buddha had not practiced jhanas at all until the time he was sitting under the rose apple tree as a boy. I know there's a passage where it says that two of his teachers were teaching him something similar to what is now called the Arupa jhanas, but it seems unlikely that that was before Arupa jhana, because those Arupa jhanas, as I'll explain later on if I have time, do necessarily require that freedom, that stability, which is born of the ordinary jhanas. You can't just skip those jhanas to get into the immaterial jhanas. And the Buddha was saying that he hadn't practiced any jhanas beforehand. And since the time of the sitting under a rose apple tree, which did seem to imply that it was not a common practice, in fact that no one was doing those jhanas. Otherwise the Buddha, seeking for teachers, would have found a teacher and practiced that. And there was good reason for why they weren't practicing jhanas, because the spiritual life in those days was intended, or was expected to be, a very austere and harsh path. And the sorts of physical requirements necessary for jhana, such as a decent meal, comfortable abiding in the body, was considered by most religious people at that time as being indulgent. Hence, when the Buddha started to do that which was necessary to prepare the foundation for jhanas, he was abandoned by his five fellow seekers. And I think there is so much evidence to say that the jhanas were forgotten in the time of the Buddha, and the Buddha actually rediscovered them, and that was one of the most important causes for his enlightenment. Basically, because to gain those jhanas, you do need the other, or many of the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. And to be able to gain the next stage of vimutti freedom, you do need those jhanas. But let's go back and say exactly how you gain those jhanas and what those jhanas actually are. And I'm going to begin with a simile which I haven't mentioned yet about meditation, which can be applied right now at your meditation, let alone when you get close to jhanas. And that's the simile of like focusing, what is many people understand as concentration. This simile was a simile from the Hindu scriptures, which was almost certainly written after the time of the Buddha in this particular scripture. It was a simile of an archery contest, where three students of the teacher were asked to take a bow and arrow and shoot a bird, a stuffed bird, a model of a bird, which was perched on a tree a long distance away, and they were told they had to shoot the bird through its eye, nowhere else, if they were to be able to succeed in this contest. And the only way they could perform such a fantastic feat of marksmanship was to really be able to concentrate, to enter a state of samadhi where you are one with the object. And so the master gave the first student the bow and arrow and said, I want you to concentrate on the target. You have to shoot that bird through its eye. You can take as long as you like to settle your mind to make it one with the target. When it is, give me a sign before you shoot. After half an hour of intense concentration, the student gave a sign. He was ready to shoot. The master asked him, can you see the bird on the tree? He said, yes. And the master pushed him aside, saying, you stupid fellow, go and learn some more meditation. And he gave the bow and arrow to the second student and gave him exactly the same instructions. And after 1 hour of solid concentration, the student gave his master the sign. And the master asked the same question, can you see the bird in the tree? He said, I can see the bird, but no tree. Stupid fellow, pushed him aside. And gave the the bow and arrow to the third disciple, with the same instructions to make yourself one with the target before shooting. And then after 2 hours, the student gave a sign. And the master asked the same question, can you see the bird in the tree? And the student said, "What tree? Can you see the bird?" "What bird?" "What can you see?" said the master. "All I can see is one eyeball." And he said, "Ah, the one with the target shoot." And the arrow went straight in the eyeball of that bird. And that was a very fascinating story, because that actually shows how the progress of samadhi, of concentration, of one pointedness, actually manifests, how it grows. It's similar to the story of when you watch the television. On your television at home, you may have, for example, a pot plant above the television. You may have some magazines underneath the television. You may have some knobs on the side of the television. When you first start watching the television, you'll be aware of all of those things. As your concentration, as your absorption into what's happening on the screen increases, you should be able to notice, not all the time, but afterwards, that in a few moments, the pot plant on top disappears. You can't see it anymore. And the magazines underneath disappear. You don't know they've disappeared, but they have disappeared, because your focus is elsewhere. If you think, oh, have they disappeared or not, then they'll come up into view again. But afterwards you'll know they've disappeared. Then even the frame of the television set will disappear. The knobs on the side, the wooden panelling will all disappear as you focus on the screen. And you won't even know the edges of the screen as you're watching that movie or that documentary. All you'll see is the centre of that screen. And if your screen or your television was round or square or diamond shaped or oblong or fractal or whatever else it was, you wouldn't know, because all of your attention will be on the screen and you would not perceive the edges of that television. It's only when the pot plant above disappears, the magazines underneath disappears, the knobs on the side, the wooden frame in the edges of the screen disappears, that you really get into the movie and you think it's real. Because what tells you is the television has all disappeared. The edges, what's above, what's beyond. You're just right in the middle of the action, as if it was real life, because real life doesn't have edges. And this is the illusion of a television. What happens with concentration is you focus in and all that's on the outside and periphery disappears. In this meditation, in the path into jhanas, exactly the same thing is happening. You're focusing on the centre and all that's on the outside, if you keep your focus on the centre, after a while will disappear. That's why I'm being very careful in this meditation course to say the next stage of the meditation is within the stage you're experiencing now. You go in to this meditation in the same way that the bird is within the branches of the tree. The head of the bird is within the body of the bird. The eye is within the head of the bird. It's all going in, focusing inwards. So as you begin the meditation, you start with present moment awareness. You focus in, and after a while, the past and the future, which is orbiting outside, around the edges, completely disappears, just like the pot plant above and the magazines underneath. You don't realize it's disappeared, but you know you're in the present moment. As you go deeper in, the edges of that television, you know, the mahogany box in which it's encased, that disappears. Now the noise, the inner commentary disappears, and you're just left with the silence. You just focus in, and it just happens all by itself. You go to the breath, and everything else disappears, just as you go into what's actually on the movie, and all you've got is the breath, and nothing else exists in the whole world. You're focusing in. And this is the important part of focusing. If you have trouble focusing on the breath, if you have especially one of the biggest hindrances, or obstacles rather, of thinking, Make sure you do not put the thoughts in the center of your screen when you're meditating. Put the breath in the center of your screen. If the thoughts are in the center of the screen, sooner or later you'll focus in on the thoughts and you'll be completely unaware of the breath. If you put the breath in the center of your screen, pretty soon you'll be unaware of the thoughts, you'll just be centered on the breath. It really depends on what you focus your attention on. In the same way, if you focus the attention on the eye of that bird, sooner or later all the rest of the bird disappears and all you see is one eyeball. That is what meditation, concentration, focusing is all about. The reason why we wander off is because we focus on the thoughts. The reason why we get disturbed by pain is because we focus on the pain. And the pain becomes the center of our screen. Or the thought becomes the center of the screen. Ill will becomes the center of the screen. It never falls off. So put the wholesome qualities in the center of the screen. Things like present moment awareness, silence, breath in the center of the screen. And then you see what happens. As you put these things in the center of the screen, eventually you get to what we call the full awareness of the breath. That full awareness of the breath is where you're continually aware of the breath. The breath stays positioned in the center of your screen. And you don't sort of have other things taking up that position, like thoughts. Sometimes you can have thoughts in your mind, but those thoughts are peripheral, on the edges. They never take up the center. As such, they have no real power to disturb you. They only have power to take away your object of concentration, your object of meditation, if they become the center. So you do not need to concern yourself about stray thoughts, about sounds which are orbiting on the outside of your field of consciousness. Be careful not to bring them into the center. Keep your meditation objects in the center. And then, by sustaining your attention on something like the breath, it happens as a natural course that the breath becomes smooth and breath becomes fine, the breath becomes peaceful. It's the nature of the breath to do that, which is why meditation on the breath was always praised as one of the best, if not the best, of meditation objects, because as you get hold of it, it changes. It means you have to be a little bit more peaceful, a little bit more mindful to keep up with it. It does actually carry you forward into deep meditation. Other meditation objects don't alter and change so delightfully, so usefully as the breath does. And that's why the Buddha used the breath, and most of the enlightened monks and nuns use the breath. So as you are watching the breath, you will notice if you keep it in mind for long enough, it will start to get soft, it will start to get peaceful all by itself. Your job on this retreat is to keep it in mind long enough, to find some skillful means, some way or another, imagination, sort of giving yourself encouragement, whatever, just to keep with that breath for long enough to start to experiencing it getting soft and peaceful. Once it gets soft and peaceful, it becomes what I call the beautiful breath. You can encourage that beautiful breath in many ways by developing the perception of the beautiful, by doing letting go around the breath, by putting loving kindness to the breath, or just by being patient enough to allow it to happen by itself. It is the nature of the breath to become that way. And eventually you will feel just so at peace, so at ease, just watching this breath. And it becomes a very calm and stable abiding. You have to be able to maintain awareness on the beautiful breath for many, many minutes before you can take on the next stage of the meditation. I'm saying this because if the mind cannot hold something like the beautiful breath, you will never be able to hold something even more refined, such as the nimitta, which is going to come next. Very often people do get nimittas coming up in their meditation, but they flash, they move all over the place, they change. You cannot keep them stable. Usually because people go to that nimitta far too quickly. It's much better, it's good meditation advice, to cultivate the awareness of the beautiful breath, even though that sometimes the mind just wants to go off onto the nimitta. Stop it, hold it back. Develop the attention on the beautiful breath more and more and more and more. Until there comes a stage when the beautiful breath and the nimitta are almost coinciding. You're watching the beautiful breath, it's so beautiful that from right within the middle of that beautiful breath, there's a beautiful nimitta shining. That nimitta, as I've mentioned before, is a reflection of your mind. It is the first pure experience of a mental object. Sometimes we think that thoughts are mental objects. In one sense they are, but they are more accurately described as echoes of the five sense world which are perceived in the mind. They've still got much to do with the world outside. They are not pure mind objects. They're not objects generated in the mind, born in the mind, living in the mind, perceived in the mind. The thoughts which we usually have are things which are born out there in the world, which the mind then takes up for contemplation and plays around with. The experience of the nimitta is the first experience of a purely mental object. It is the mind seeing the mind. That's why it is quite weird and strange. It's weird and strange because it's an object which, when it first appears, you haven't got the means to recognize. You don't know what to make of it. And that's why sometimes nimittas can come up to meditators and you can't recognize them, you don't know what it is. It is most common for meditators to experience the nimitta as a light, for the only reason that it has, the experience of the nimitta has some qualities about it, some characteristics, which is just remotely similar to seeing a beautiful light. There's enough similarity there, but it's very remote similarity for perception. When it's struggling to find a meaning for this experience, to actually see it as a light. The nimitta is not a light. The nimitta is not a physical feeling. The eye, the vision door, the vision consciousness has long since shut down. You can't see anything. The bodily feeling is long since shut down. You can't feel anything in the body. It's a pure mental experience, but we are not used to what mental experiences are. We just do not know what to make of it, because all of our language from which perception comes, all of our language is just to do with the outside world. We just haven't got the words to describe it to ourselves. We just struggle for some description, and the usual description people have is of a light. It's similar to a light, but it is not a light. The important thing to notice, it does not matter what the colour is, it does not matter what the shape is. What matters in the nimitta is its quality of beauty and its stability. Its beauty, whether it's just a really shining, radiant, beautiful, amazingly wonderful thing, is a sign of the energy in the mind. Once you play around with nimittas a lot, you know if the nimittas are dull, just cloudy, grey, misty, it's a sign that the mind has not got enough energy. It's unlikely that that nimitta, unless you're very skillful, it's unlikely that nimitta would lead you into jhanas. You haven't got enough oomph in your mind. What you need to do is to go back to the beautiful breath and build up some steam, first of all. Build up some energy. And you do this, and you will find, if you go back to the beautiful breath and just disregard the grey misty limiters, or just the limiters which might be a nice light but not bright enough. Go back to the beautiful breath for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and when you go to the limiter again, it's much more incandescent. It's like turning up the voltage and things begin to glow. The brilliance of the limiter, its beauty, is a sign of the energy in the mind. Sometimes people can get brilliant limiters, but they don't last very long. Its stability is a sign of the calmness in the mind. If the limiter keeps coming and going, starts flashing like fireworks, it is not ready yet. You're not ready yet to take hold of that limiter and go into deeper meditation. Go again, back to the beautiful breath, and develop a sense of calmness and patience. And then, when a limiter comes up, it comes up slowly, gently, instead of flashing up, and it stays. Simply because you've been training yourself to hold the attention on the beautiful breath, you've been training the mind in samadhi, the ability to sustain attention. If you can sustain the attention on a coarse thing, you're much more likely to sustain the attention on a refined thing. Once you've practiced sustaining your attention on a refined thing, you can sustain your attention, maybe, on something even more refined. You cannot rush too fast in this practice. So if an imitator comes up, to know by its sense of beauty whether you have enough energy in the mind or not, to know by its sense of stability whether you have enough calm in the mind or not. Remember what I was saying about these nimittas. The nimitta is a sign of the mental consciousness appearing and becoming dominant. The five senses are usually the dominant senses. And in that simile which I gave, putting two hands in front of me, usually the five senses are very strong, the mind is just so soft that it gets completely swamped, so much so you can't perceive the mind. When the five senses start to calm down, when you start to let go of sight, sound, smell, taste and bodily touch, when you start to let go of the body, those five senses start to calm down until their intensity is about equal to the mind consciousness. That's when limiters flash up, when the mind manifests and appears. But it only comes for a short time, because if you just turn at that moment and pay attention to the mind, rather than paying attention to the calming of the five senses just bump up again. Just the limiter just disappears very quickly. You need to really calm those five senses down. Calm them, calm them, calm them. Even though the mind is even stronger, keep the attention on the five senses. In other words, on the beautiful breath. The beautiful breath is the last of the five senses. Touch. Physical sensation. And you're maintaining that, calming that down, putting all your attention on it, because by putting your attention on a beautiful breath, you are subduing especially sound. Sound is one of the other very dangerous senses which can very easily come in and disturb the meditation. Here, put your attention on that beautiful breath. It's just on the fifth sense of bodily touch, in its most refined and subtle form, and it likes to go away, but you're just keeping it, just so you can sustain your attention on those five senses and make sure they really are subdued, until they go right down to the very bottom of their intensity. And then, if you turn to the mind door, the mind consciousness, the limiter, then you'll be able to sustain your attention. And the fire of the five senses is so well put out, it doesn't flare up again and disturb you. This is that part of the process of jhana which is called vivicchehi kammehi, having overcome the five senses. Karma, this is not karma as in action and the law of karma, this is karma, K long A M A. It is the world of the five senses. The first part of the description, classical description of jhanas, is having become secluded from the five senses. However, the next part of first jhana is having also become secluded from the unwholesome dhammas, in particular the five hindrances. And I mention this because a question was last night about jhanas and the five hindrances and how they are connected. When you get to animitta, karma chanda, which is the first hindrance, the concern for the five senses, is completely overcome, as also is ill will. By the time animitta come up, those two senses are gone. Sloth and torpor is gone also. Doubt that can still come down, come up here, and this can also come, the more important, restlessness. Of those five hindrances, restlessness is the last to disappear, and the most difficult one to overcome. It is the restlessness which is the sign of the doer. Even though the other hindrances are gone, the doer equals restlessness is still remaining. That's why it is sometimes very difficult to maintain the nimitta, because we are restless. If that nimitta does come up, please remember that it is a reflection of your mind. Please remember the two metaphors. The first metaphor, which I've been mentioning a lot, about Ajahn Chah's simile of the still forest pool. If you move, the animals know you're there and they will scurry away. You cannot move. You shouldn't move, because if you do move, nimitta goes away. Or the other metaphor, which is very helpful, is remembering it's the reflection of your mind. Imagine that it's you standing in a mirror looking at yourself. If the image in the mirror starts to move, you can grab hold of that mirror and try and hold it still, but that doesn't help anything. The reason why the image in the mirror is moving is because the one who is watching is moving. So if a nimitta comes up, don't try and hold the nimitta still. Just make sure the one who's watching is still. It's a slightly different perspective, but it's one which works. If you get a nimitta and try and play with it by moving it this way and that way, by expanding it, by getting it small or brightening up or whatever, then you're wasting your time. What you have to do is to pay a little bit of attention to that which is watching. Make sure that that is not moving and disturbing everything. If the one who is watching is still, the image in the mirror will be still. The nimitta will just stay there and will not move, will not shudder. This is what we mean by restlessness. The restlessness is always wanting to do something, to control something. That is the biggest of the hindrances, especially in this part of the meditation. It is the one reason, the one biggest hindrance why people can't get into that meditation. So often that manifests as the two enemies standing at the gates of jhana. And those two enemies are fear and excitement. As I read out in that sutta, Mahasatika Sutta, even the Buddha was afraid of that pleasure. Sometimes not just because it's pleasure, just because of the immensity of that pleasure. These jhanas are huge states. The biggest thing which would have ever happened to you in your life. If you think that sexual orgasm is good, it's nothing compared to the bliss of jhanas. This is powerful. This is just blows you away. This is real bliss. That's why afterwards just people sometimes come out just crying, just with happiness, like bursting. So it's very fearful sometimes. Sometimes you wonder if you can handle that. It's powerful. That's why if you come from a Christian tradition, you think it's God. Almighty. Powerful. Because, I mean, this is much more powerful than you could ever imagine. That's why sometimes when you face these things, say, I'm not ready for this. I can't handle this. And fear comes up. And as soon as fear comes up, everything wobbles and cracks up. And very often, instead of even going back to the beautiful breath, you go right back to the very beginning. just with heart pounding and just really confused. You've come so close and you've blown it. So by giving that a piece of advice, don't feel afraid. You've got so much wonderful things to get from that jhana. As I just read out from the suttas, the Buddha found that was the path to Nibbana. And he was afraid, so don't feel sorry about yourself or feel guilty. You're in good company. But don't be afraid. Have that confidence and trust. Use faith to take you over that fear. Secondly, you have the wow response. For those of you who have heard me talking about these jhanas and get all excited, and suddenly it starts to appear, at last! And you've blown it. 9 days of hard work and then just one wow. And then you go right back to the very beginning again. As one of the meditators and interviewers was reminding me, it's like snakes and ladders. I don't know if you remember that child game of snakes and ladders, but just, you know, on the 100th square, just one square away from home, there's this big snake. And if you just land just one square next to winning the game, you go right down to the very beginning again. The longest snake in snakes and ladders is the one which is closest to the goal. And that's when you go, wow. That's just like Ajahn Chah in that simile. This amazing animal comes out and you go, wow. Oh, blown it. And it goes away. And it doesn't come out again for a long time. Because it knows there's someone looking there. The jhanas are very shy. That's why very few people can actually see them. Because you've got to be so quiet. If the jhanas know you're watching, they won't come. So, if you can, just be wary of those two responses. The wow and the fear. What happens is that nimitta, by its own very nature, will start to grow in intensity, simply because if you leave it alone, because of sustained attention, because of just being with, because of not moving, this is the nature of energy to build up. What usually happens is you, but quite naturally, in a nimitta, the most beautiful part is in its center. The brightest, most brilliant part. This is another sort of skillful means, using nimittas, if you can remember this. If you allow your attention to go to the center, because I make that suggestion now, the mind in these states is very sensitive, and very likely, just because I made that suggestion, that's all it needs for the mind to go looking in the center, where the beautiful part is. And it will be like the simile of the bird shooting it through the eye, like the simile of the television. Because that's the most beautiful part, the mind will feel it getting sucked in. The external, the outer rim of the nimitta will disappear. The outer parts of the nimitta will disappear. You go in and in and in and in, focusing inwards to the very heart of this nimitta. It is why that people very often have the experience where the nimitta changes into the jhana, like falling into a beautiful space. Or sometimes just the nimitta just coming up and enveloping them and swallowing them all up. Sometimes it happens that when a person falls into the nimitta, they just come out the other side again. Just too much excitement. They haven't been able to hold that state, they've gone too fast. They've just gone to a beautiful place, but just for a fraction of a second. It's not really a jhana. They just, you know, had a quick visit, that's all, a quick peek through the window. But that's really worthwhile, because that will blow you away. Nevertheless, with a bit more skill, and that skill is just the ability to be patient, to be slow in the meditation, to spend lots of time in such things as a beautiful breath, spend lots of time just being with the nimitta. Don't hurry the process. You find that when you enter gently, rather than rushing in. You enter gently and you stay in for a long period of time. As soon as you enter into a jhana, say as soon as a nimitta sort of envelops you, you fall into it, or whatever it is, your experience, from that point on, you will have no control. You will not be able to give any orders anymore. like you normally do. The very idea, what should I do next, cannot come up. This is why that once you get in these states, you cannot sort of decide what to do next. You cannot even decide to come out. And that, secondly, because the attention is so fixed, because it hasn't got any perspective, you cannot really make sense at the time of what's going on. When you're in a jhana, you haven't got a means of knowing what jhana it is. It's just the consciousness is, as it were, almost like blinkers. Just one pointed. To be able to understand something, you need comparison. You need to compare this with that. This is what it's like, what's gone. I'm over here, I was over there. You need comparison to be able to answer those questions. In the jhanas, just there's so much one-pointedness, there's no comparison there. So one of the characteristics while you're in the jhana is you haven't got a clue what's happening, where you are. You're just blissed out. It's only afterwards, when you emerge from that jhana, that you use this mindfulness, which happens quite naturally, of reviewing, reflecting on what happened. What was that? And then you can bring up the experience and add the perspective. Now you can use the experience, use the memory of the experience, which is very clear and very accurate. And from where you're sitting outside of jhana, you can understand what it was. Yeah. But some of the things you will know, and this is important so you know whether it's a jhana or not, is the five senses completely disappeared, cut off, gone. One of the characteristics of a jhana which tells you whether it's a jhana or not, perhaps one of the most important, so you know where you are in this meditation, is that no sound can be heard. You can't hear the birds, you can't hear people coming and going out. If someone coughs, even if sort of someone shouts really loudly, or someone is playing their CD next to you, you can't hear it. The mind is so absorbed in itself that the connection of the mind to the sound is completely cut off for the time being. Nor can you feel the body. If someone taps you on the shoulder, you won't be able to feel it. They can tap you, they can move you. I mentioned before, one of the meditators in Perth who flew to very deep jhana once, was taken to hospital and had even defibrillators put on him, electric shocks, and didn't feel a thing. He just, even though he's bouncing up and up and down on this sort of the bed in the emergency ward in the hospital, he didn't hear anything, couldn't feel anything. That's what we mean about jhana. Let alone if someone taps you, even if they put electric shocks on you, you can't feel them. That's a degree to which the senses are cut off. So that's a very good sign by which afterwards, when you come out, if you can ask inside, is this a jhana, is this not a jhana? Absolutely no way. If you can ask that question, that's the surest sign it's not a jhana. Because the second thing about in all jhanas is you can't think. You can't make that thought, you can't have that question. Because the mind is still. In the first jhana, there's something called vitakka vichara, two of the five factors of first jhana. And in the translation I had here, which I read out, Bhikkhu Bodhi said, initial and applied thought. I can understand why he translated that, but it's not quite accurate. There is no thought within a jhana. What actually that means, initial and applied, or vitakka vichara in the first jhana, it means the first movement of the mind, which would usually generate thought, but which in a jhana is far too refined, it cannot just produce that inner speech. What it actually is that once one is in that jhana, the first jhana, the object which you're aware of, which you only can describe to yourself afterwards, is bliss. It's a particular type of bliss. It is called the Piti Sukha, born of the five senses disappearing. It is the Vivekaja Piti Sukha. Five senses are completely gone, and that is the bliss. That is where it comes from. That is what the happiness actually is. And that's what the attention is drawn towards and held on. However, in this first jhana, the mind still wants to try and grab onto it. Because it grabs onto that Piti Sukha, that grabbing on is called vichara, holding on. Because that holding on is not necessary at this stage, it's enough just to create a small wobble in the mind, that as if the mind just goes a little bit away from the Piti Sukha. The Piti Sukha just gets a tiny bit less or changes or slightly. Because of that, when the attention just goes out from a full absorption into the Piti Sukha, the Piti Sukha is still so strong, so attractive, you go straight back in again. That's the vitaka. I mean a wobble in the whole experience. It's such a tiny wobble, it's still counted as ekagata, which does not mean one-pointedness of mind. Eka means one, aga means peak. Just like the peak of a mountain. It is one point in one sense, but not an ordinary point, a high peak of bliss. That little wobble is only because the mind just can't just hold it. Still is just can't just sort of hold it effortlessly. Still just a tiny bit of doing left. And that's not you doing it, it's just the mind. The Buddha's chief disciple, Venerable Sariputta, described the state within or between the first and second jhana, where the vitaka had gone, but the vichara was still left. And you can understand that as the mind is just holding that Piti Sukha object. It is just the natural process because it's so attractive, it's just like super glue. It realizes it's still holding it, but it's not holding that so disturbingly that it moves off. The vichara is there, there's no need for the vitaka because it doesn't move away from the object. But very soon the vichara just opens up. You realize it doesn't need to hold on to that Piti Sukha. The vichara disappears and the Piti Sukha just stays there all by itself. This is why the Buddha called the second jhana the Piti Sukha born of true samadhi. True samadhi because the mind does not move at all. It is full, complete, sustained attention. That sustained attention, I mentioned this the other day, which is a very important part of understanding meditation, understanding the jhanas, is because of ajatang sampasadana, because of full confidence in that internal object, the Piti Sukha within the mind, the bliss within the mind. Because the mind is so confident, it does not need to hold it hard or soft or hold it at all. Because of that confidence, that faith, it becomes a full, complete letting go. That second jhana, again, when one enters these states, one doesn't know which jhana one goes into at first. And if that second jhana is gone into, when one emerges from all the jhanas afterwards, one always recognizes that as a very solid and fixed state. A state which people come out and say they're like a stone, fixed, solid, like rock. Rock samadhi. Simply because there's no movement whatsoever in any which way. And again, just like the first jhana, the inability to make any thought, the inability to make any choice, the experience which you have afterwards is chetana has completely gone, disappeared. That's one of the weird parts of that experience. Obviously, the first part of the experience you'll be fascinated by is the sheer bliss of it. Wow, this is great. And the second part, when you start analysing it, this was really strange. I just could not do anything in that state. And it's a very clear sense that there was some part of you that is no longer there. The doer. When I say the doer and the knower, the doer and the knower, you can get some sort of idea what I'm talking about. But only when you get into a jhana can you really fully appreciate what I mean by the doer. Only when it's gone can you know what it is. In the same way, the old well-worn simile, a tadpole born in the water, lived all its life in the water. It's only when it leaves the water can it know what water is. Only when you leave the doer can you fully understand what the doer is and how you've believed in it and had confidence and faith in it and even put it on a shrine and worshipped it as me. So that's the second doer, the second jhana, say, when the doer completely disappears. And it's that sense of rock samadhi. And that's blissful. And one of the things you start to realize also, it's a different type of bliss than the first jhana. The first jhana is the bliss of the five senses going. The second jhana is the bliss of samadhi. The full one-pointedness, the rock bliss. And again, realizing that this rock-type bliss, the bliss of samadhi, is even much more delicious than the first bliss, you start to really get some amazing insights into the nature of bliss. If you get into jhana for the first time, you think, this is ultimately, can never be anything more than this. When you get into second jhana, and that's what blows you away, there is something more than that bliss. There's super bliss. That's why people in the world, they think that sometimes there's nothing happier than going to watch the footy on an Anzac Day. They don't know anything better, that's why. And sometimes people think there's nothing better than sort of sex, because they know nothing better, that's all. Some people think there's nothing better than love and relationships. It's understandable because they know nothing better. Some people get first jhana and think that's it. They know nothing better. That's why. This really gets you understanding Dhamma. Why it is we get attached. And how we can get unattached. Not from some sort of willpower or thinking, if I'm a Buddhist, I should be detached, therefore I'm going to be detached. You can't do it just for your willpower, just because you decide to do so. I'm going to be detached today. I'm going to be enlightened. That time we became enlightened. Okay, let's just detach. I'm going to get all my detachments, all my cravings from now on. You won't be able to do it for 5 minutes. Because it's the nature of the mind to do this. And the only way you can detach is by doing a training which sees something more, which sees something different. And if you saw a higher pleasure, would you really sort of be interested in a lower pleasure? Because you can't be. It's not, it doesn't interest you anymore. You just can't get into it. Why get into sex or relationships when you can have jhanas? Wow, I mean, it's stupid. It's like being a masochist, torturing yourself, sex and relationships, when you can have just jhanas, which are just so beautiful and so freeing, and you've got no bad side effects and doesn't tie you down. But I can say that, but until you can taste that, jhana is just some sort of idea. And it doesn't work unless you've experienced it. Once you do experience, it becomes natural that you just turn away from the world. So that once you get that second jhana, you experience the bliss, the different stages of ecstasy. And if you're fortunate, you may even get into a third jhana. The difference between the second jhana and the first jhana is you're letting go of a disturbance of the mind. This vitaka vichara, which is just, the mind is still doing a tiny bit of controlling. The difference between the third jhana and the second jhana is the abandoning of this excitement of the mind called pity. Sometimes many meditators have argued, what's the difference between pity and sukha? You only know that difference if you can get into a third jhana. The experience which you're feeling is devoid of something which is always being present with happiness. There's an aspect of happiness which is always there except in this one experience. And then you understand that what's left, you know, ah, that was pity. In the same way, when the frog leaves the water, it understands, ah, that's what water was. That's why all the philosophizing, all the looking at the books, all the researching and the meaning of these words in the Pali canon, in Sanskrit and everything else, isn't worth the 16th part of the experience itself. If you can experience the third jhana, then you know what piti is. But then you have a hard time explaining it and putting it into words. But you know what it is. And this is the experience of third jhana, just something else falls away. The way you get in from one jhana to the next is you just really get into the habit of letting go, of giving up, of abandoning. You're encouraged because every time you let go of a bit more, you get more bliss. It's the reward conditioning. Because you get more and more bliss, when you let go more and more, it becomes the nature of the mind to follow that path of more and more letting go. The mind, even within the jhana, without you doing anything, just wants to abandon. It does it all by itself. You can't do it, you can't make the decision, you can't decide. The mind just lets go. Just gets into that habit, gets into that movement. The more momentum of letting go you have outside of jhana, the deeper you go into the jhanas. You really get into letting go, abandoning, giving up, giving away, letting go. And when you get into the first jhana, you just become a habit, you just let go a bit more. As a natural result, a natural inclination, depending on what you were doing before you went in. And that's how you develop the deeper jhanas. There is a way later on, if you can remember those jhanas, if you've got experience with them, if the mind knows the territory, then you can do adhidhana, determining, telling the mind what to do. Basically, if you've got a chauffeur, and the chauffeur knows the way to Nolamara, knows the way to Dhammasara Nansa Monastery, knows the way to Serpentine, then all you need to do is to tell the driver, go to Serpentine. Because the driver knows what you're talking about and knows the way, you don't need to do any more, the driver will just go off. But if you've never been to Perth before and you haven't got a clue where Serpentine is, where Nolamara is, where Dhammasara Nansa Monastery is, and you tell the driver who's never been to Perth before, just go to Dhammasara, all the determinations in the world won't work. The way of determination only works when there's some previous experience of these states. And also, there has to be fuel in the car. It has to be the karma. The conditions are right, enough letting go, you can actually get into those states. As you develop these states more and more from the third jhana, where there's still that happiness left, that's the next thing you let go of, the happiness to get to pure equanimity. The equanimity is a type of happiness, but it's a much more refined bliss, the bliss of perfect peace and stillness, where the mind isn't moving. It's not even happiness there. Complete stillness of mind. In the suttas, that's where they say that mindfulness is its purest. That's the highest state of mindfulness. So, if you think that jhanas are just abandoning mindfulness, the word of the Buddha states that it's the parisuddhi, sati parisuddhi, of the purity of mindfulness. So this is perfectly mindful, perfectly aware, but in a way which you've never experienced before, so you have to come out afterwards to really understand it. If you want to continue those jhanas further, you'll be further abandoning parts of consciousness, because that's what you've been doing in the lower jhanas, abandoning the knower. In that simile which I've given, you abandon the doer first of all, then you abandon the knower, after the doer to be abandoned. Abandoning the knower is very difficult to do. Who's abandoning the knower? Is the knower abandoning the knower? Is the doer abandoning the knower? It just abandons itself. In this particular case, I can't avoid the beautiful simile, which is quite close to the simile of the archer shooting the bird. It's the simile in Alice in Wonderland of the Cheshire Cat, which is a very beautiful simile of jhanas. In the simile, or in the story, I remember reading it since I first invented that simile many years ago. There wasn't the whole body of the cat, it was just the head of the cat appeared in the sky. And it was, I think, the Red Queen told the executioner to cut off his head. He said, "It's only got a head, how can you cut off its head if it hasn't got a body?" He said, "Don't argue, do it." You know what queens are like. But anyway. And so that was, you know, part of the amusing dialogue in that very witty book. But then, this was like a Cheshire cat, and it's a particular species of cat whose mouth is so arranged it's in a continuous smile, at least it appears to be that way. And according to the book, this was an image appeared in the sky, a marvellous metaphor for an imitator. And the image started to disappear. First of all, from the outside, the ears started to disappear, and then it disappeared inwards. As the eyes disappeared, and then finally the nose disappeared, and then finally the lips of the cat disappeared, but not the smile. The cat disappeared, just leaving a smile in the sky. And straight away you think, how can that happen? How can there be a smile without any lips? But that's precisely what happens in jhana. There's a smile, the mental image of happiness and bliss, but there's nothing doing the smiling. And I'm not quite sure, you know, what that Lewis Carroll was about, whether that was just a fortunate simile. But that is just so perfect, it just sometimes sends shivers up your spine. You see, everything disappearing and just leaving the happiness. Disembodied bliss, which is what jhanas are all about. So that's what the jhanas are. Again, when I talk about jhanas, I really get off on it, so I speak too long. And it is time for the interviews now, so I'm going to have to tidy up the talk, and maybe I'll talk later about how those jhanas are used to gain insights which enlightens you, which completely abandons everything. I think that's enough to tell you what the jhanas are. If you come close to these things, you may remember what to do so that you don't waste the experience. In my life teaching others meditation, it has happened that people have sometimes fluked the nimitta and come so close, or just because of they have practiced quite well and they come up to these stages and they don't know what to do next, and they waste marvellous opportunities. So I'm saying this, so if it happens this retreat or the next retreat or later on in your life, hopefully something will recall the instructions. You will not be afraid of the nimitta. You won't think, "Oh, I better not do this, I might get attached." Never ever think like that. This is the way of the Buddha. It's stages of letting go. Have confidence, have faith. This is worthwhile. Just let go. Remember, these are just images of your mind. Don't move the knower. Keep everything still. Allow yourself to fall in. And just when you come out afterwards, you'll be a very happy little meditator. Any questions on that? Yes, okay, just two questions and that's all, quickly. Yes?
Don't you think that it's very dangerous to be in the jhana because your family member doesn't, they don't know you, and they call you like that
and send you for convention? No, it's very unlikely that would happen. And I don't think even you could be injured in a jhana. So you're perfectly safe. It's not dangerous at all. Don't be afraid. In fact, it's very dangerous not to get into a jhana. Because then your children would argue with you. They'd cause you so many sleepless nights. They want all your money. They'll cause you so many troubles and problems. That's what you'd be dangerous of. And that does happen. and I don't mean the dangers in jhana are just tiny. The only danger in a jhana, there is, when I say you can't get attached to jhanas, there is a slight attachment which is possible to jhanas. What that attachment means is you're only a non-returner, a nanagami, rather than being a full arahat. That's the only danger in jhanas. You're not fully enlightened, you're just a non-returner. But you can see that's not much of a danger, for those of you who aren't even stream winners yet. So there's no danger at all. Please do not be worried. These are powerful states, and if you overcome that fear and actually go into them, you come up and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. These are powerful. This is what you've been waiting many lifetimes for. You can have children any lifetime. You want jhana this lifetime. Okay, yes? I kind of have two questions, and otherwise,
I've heard that people have told me that it's very difficult to achieve my pointedness with just an awareness of breath or a gross physical movement that you're arriving and falling at the abdomen. Similarly, Dave, you needed a very fine object for your saw and wood. You wouldn't concentrate on the saw or the wood, but only at the point where the feet cut the wood. And that if you were only using the cut of the breath, you would not feel that fine.
Yeah, so you're saying that you need a very fine object to get into a jhana, to achieve one-pointedness. The idea of one-pointedness, which was very important in my practice, was to realize it's not one-pointedness in space, but one-pointedness in time is important. Because space has to be abandoned. The perception of space means the perception of body. The touch on the tip of the nose is too coarse to take you into jhanas. You're still aware of the body. And that's one of the problems with focusing on the nose or focusing on the tip of the nose or whatever. It just still keeps the door open for bodily consciousness to keep coming up. The sooner you can abandon bodily consciousness and just get what I call the feeling of the breath, disembodied feeling of the breath, don't put it anywhere, then the more refined your consciousness can be. So it's when you say just watching the point where the saw hits the tip of the blade, it's much better just to even like disembody. You're not quite sure whether that sawtooth is the beginning or the end or wherever it is. It's just a tooth happening now. And it completely, the perception starts to completely change and becomes very refined. And this is something which was very confusing to me for many years, but you know, from my own experience, that you realize that you have to let go of the body, the sooner the better. And I was very pleased when I started to learn Pali and look at the suttas. You never saw the Buddha even once saying where you should watch the breath. He never said at the nose, he never said in the belly, he never said anywhere, he just said watch the breath. Just so you know it's going in, you know it's going out, you can calm that feeling. That you know the breath, not that you know the nose. Sometimes people have hay fever, they have colds, and they just cannot watch it on the tip of the nose. Sometimes they have to watch it through the mouth or whatever. It doesn't matter where you watch the breath. Okay,